Good morning. Welcome to Cool Science Radio. Some craziness going on with our board there and the sound. But here we are, Cool Science Radio.
What was that sound?
There's no telling. I'm Lynn Ware-Peak, here with my co-host, John Wells. Cool Science Radio is a weekly program about science and technology. It's all about making it entertaining and accessible. Today, we start off the program by talking about digital citizenship. Now, what is that? Well, it's the skills that all of us, but especially our children, must develop to exist in a digital world, and how the influences and impacts must be controlled and shaped. We'll speak with Max Rogers. He's the program director of NetSmarts. That's a group which teaches digital citizenship and addresses some of the realities of screen addiction, cyberbullying, and some different approaches he'll present to countering the effects of these things.
Hidden Figures is a film that just came out last week, but it began as a book that tells the incredible untold story of Katherine G. Johnson, Dorothy Vaughan, and Mary Jackson, brilliant African-American women working at NASA, who served as the brains behind one of the greatest operations in history, the launch of astronaut John Glenn into orbit. It's a stunning achievement that restored the nation's confidence, turned around the space race, galvanized the world. We spoke with the book's author, Margot Lee Shetterly, in September, and on the success of this film and big holiday weekend of movie going, we thought we'd give you a little bit more of a look into this important and previously untold story.
All that, plus some cool stories about cool science when we return. Stay with us.
This is Earl Foote, founder of Nexus IT, a proud sponsor of Cool Science Radio on KPCW. Nexus IT provides comprehensive cybersecurity solutions to help protect your business from hackers and today's internet-borne security threats. More information at nexusitc.net or at 435-487-9099.
Hi, I'm Davey Ratcher from Park City Mountain and proud supporter of KPCW. Park City Mountain hosts winter events throughout the season, including the annual Torchlight Parade, New Year's Eve celebration, Spring Groove, and more. More information about all Park City Mountain events can be found at parkcitymountain.com.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware-Peak, here with John Wells. Well, we all operate in the digital age and deal with mobile devices capturing our attention, distracting us, making us attempt to multitask, which we've learned that none of us really can do. But how to navigate this realm when it comes to our children, our teenagers, is especially difficult. It's something we weren't up against as teens ourselves. And so to know the right thing or even have the right information about it all is a challenge. Kids spend an average of 6.5 hours a day on screens, and that does not include classroom or homework screen time. Last week, the documentary Screenagers was shown in town here. It was a program underwritten by the Park City Day School, and a fascinating panel discussion was held afterwards. One of the panelists and someone who spends every day talking about digital citizenship is Max Rogers. He's the program director for NetSmarts, and he's full of great information and gives motivational student trainings that focus on positivity and empowerment. The topics he'll discuss include cyberbullying, sexting, internet predators, and social media. Max Rogers, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you, Lynn. It's great to be here.
Well, it's really, great to have you back. You had so many good things to say last week when Screenagers was screened here at the Jim Santee Auditorium. First, let's start off, Max, by just telling us, what is your definition of digital citizenship?
Yeah, so I like to define digital citizenship in regards to something that we understand really well, our normal citizenship in the real world. I often explain it to students in a way that I think is an easy way to understand it, and that is just like being a good digital or being a good citizen in the real world means helping others, being nice, polite, picking up trash as you walk on the sidewalk, and taking care of each other. Generally, being a good digital citizen is the same. As we spend our time online, as we see a mean or rude comment, we can add a positive one to make our digital world a better place. We can contribute in positive ways online as we share content, upload videos, and communicate with each other. If we do so in a positive way, we're becoming good digital citizens and contributing to a positive future for the internet, which, in all honesty, I think students are getting that message. And so that's one of the things that we love to share. And they're responding really well to it.
Well, that's good to hear. It seems to me that, you know, we can hide behind our screens, really. And so maybe some of the things that would, play on our moral fiber about the right thing to do may be sort of squelched by the ability, like I said, to hide behind a screen. Is that true? And how do you communicate that it's really not so to teenagers?
Yeah. I think it's tough to get that message. For me, it's all about giving students the perspective as good as you can. And obviously, we don't reach all of them, and we do our best to reach as many as possible. But there are a few students here and there who fail to get that message or get lost in the moment and don't gain the perspective of thinking about their futures and thinking about the effect in general that either a negative comment or cyberbullying has on other students. And they do make those mistakes. And honestly, all of us make mistakes at some point in the real world or online. And so kind of a good reminder for the students is to do our best to bring them out of that and remind them that they actually have a lot of power here, that they have influence over the future of the internet, and that they have a role to play. And almost like the beginning of a superhero story, we try and give them that vision and make that change within. And it seems to be working for the most part. Students seem to be responding. We survey our students. And in regard to bullying and cyberbullying especially, 94% of our students agreed, or they strongly agree, that they're more likely to report cyberbullying after participating in our trainings. And we feel like that's a great thing. So and we've seen the response just in the students themselves. We've had schools contact us after our trainings, and students have done certain things to help others. We have students who've written anonymous notes to other students, positive notes, and posted them on their lockers, and other things like that. And I think that's kind of a sign that they do get it, and we are making a bit of an impact and a change for the future of the internet.
Good morning, Max. How are you? Good morning, Max.
Good morning.
Regarding internet addiction, we've had a number of guests on our program that have talked about this subject, and some have offered anecdotal information on what they believe it's all about and those sorts of things. And we've had a couple of guests that have brought some hard science, peer-reviewed studies that talk about how difficult this problem is becoming and how we're not doing enough about it. And also, China last year came out and said their number one health problem is internet addiction. South Korea, at about the same time, opened up more than a dozen internet addiction centers throughout their country. Where is our government? Where's the United States on all of this?
Yeah, and it's, I don't have a good handle on the science part, as you probably recognize, but I do think we need more. And I don't think it comes in a form of anything other than what we're doing. In fact, next year, each year we change our trainings and presentations to what we talk about as far as our topics to students. And our biggest topic we're planning for next year is that of talking about digital devices and the time that we spend on those devices and how sometimes those devices end up controlling us. I sat with a small group of students, just kind of like a focus group the other day, and asked them about what was driving them in their lives in regards to technology. What did they like? What did they not like? And one of the things that they brought up is that they are responding to social media messages, and they are participating in discussions in the middle of the night when they should be sleeping because their phone vibrates and wakes them up or makes its noise or chime, and they immediately respond. And so there is an addiction there that it is impeding and causing a negative effect in just the general well-to-do and even health of the young people that we work with. And so I think we need more programming. We need more people talking about it. We do need a regular conversation in schools. Programs like ours that are going to address it, I think, are going to make a difference, because just in having that conversation with those students, I feel like they started to get a grasp on, you know what, this is important. I'm going to put my phone on silent when I sleep, get the rest I need, and then get back to what's important in my life.
Right.
More meaningful, real conversations. Not even that those conversations necessarily have to take place non-digitally, but they do take place, and that they're not tired throughout the day, too tired to make that kind of thing happen.
Yeah, and my sense is that there's some good old-fashioned parenting that's not happening. And the reason I say that is, you know, we all see kids just hanging out with each other, just kids with kids, and we see them buried in their devices and those sorts of things. But we also go to restaurants or public places where there are kids with their moms and dads, and they're sitting around a table, and the kids are totally immersed in their iPhone or their whatever. And the parents aren't doing anything about it. And so I know you have education for kids and you have education for parents. Do you want to talk about that?
Yeah. Our education for parents is limited. Our funding from the state focuses on reaching the youth, which we do a pretty good job of. We are training currently about 70% of the schools in the state each year. But our training to parents is very limited. While we do a few parent trainings here and there, it's more of a pilot program for us. And we hope to get funding either from the state or from maybe a tech-related business in Utah to sponsor something of this. In fact, Google Fiber sponsored a small pilot this summer for us to do parent training. And during that pilot, we learned some good things. Our ideas in regards to training parents is when we do the trainings, that we create opportunities for parents to have regular discussions with their kids. And these are discussions, not the parents saying, here's our mandate from with our power and this is what you will or won't do, but to involve the students. And because when we do our trainings with students, we always send our students home to talk to their parents and to teach their parents what they learned. And we don't know how many actually go home and do that. But our goal is to eventually do the same thing with parents and bring them together where they start having regular, meaningful conversations at home, where they create a plan in their home of how they're going to deal with these digital devices. Part of that conversation is, what do we do with mobile devices while we're eating dinner? Mm-hmm. We put them in a basket, and do we have face-to-face conversations during that time? I think that's a great plan, but that's something that both the student and the parent need to decide together. It doesn't work if the parents do it, and it doesn't. Obviously, the parents or the students and the parents need to come together on it. And there's a lot of other ideas that we have in regards to that too. One of those conversation topics that they should have, especially with the younger students that are spending a ton of time gaming, is to promote constructive gaming. Opportunities that also provide education, or to limit the gaming time so that instead of spending hours just mowing down zombies in some mindless game, they're also building in Minecraft, or they spend an hour doing homework in some on way digitally because they want to spend that time online, but then an hour doing something where they can take a break. But these are meaningful trade-offs that a parent and a student can make after having these conversations. We recommend every couple of months that the household meets together and updates that plan. What is working? What's not working?
Yeah, that's so great. And because you do most of your work with children, I'm curious, you must hear some stories about parents and their screen addiction. You know, I mean, if when we ask our kids to pay attention and put their phone away, we often are sitting there with the screen in front of our face ourselves, and somehow we justify it by saying, "Oh well, I'm you know doing work emails, and or I'm doing something meaningful like reading some facts on Wikipedia or whatever it is." But it's still no justification.
Yeah, you know, and I would love to do some actual surveying to get hard data on this. But one of the funny things that we found lately is, we've actually been talking to middle school and high school students about texting and driving this past year. It's been one of our main topics. And obviously, many of the high school students are driving. And we ask them often how many of them text and drive. And there could be some reporting bias here, but mm-hmm. the number was pretty low. I was impressed. Honestly, when we started this year, I thought more high school students would be texting and driving. But we also asked those same students, middle school and high school students who aren't driving yet, and then those that are, how many have ridden with their parents or an older sibling while they've texted and drive? And that number is always way higher, at least three or four times as many raise their hand. And again, it could be, this is just an informal survey. It could be some performance or some surveying bias, but it was just something I kind of was curious about. So if I looked at that, And if it was actually true, that would mean our parents are struggling more with texting and driving than our students are. And whether that's true or not, it's an interesting concept to bring up. Perhaps those who grew up with technology their whole lives are doing a little bit better in the car with it.
Yeah.
Or perhaps those who started midway through our lives and they're trying to pick up on are having a tougher time curbing that addiction when that phone rings or vibrates on the seat next to us while we're driving. But it does bring up interesting concept that, you know, there is a difference in these two individuals and how we're dealing with technology. And maybe our natives are doing a little bit better in some things.
Yeah, that's a really good point. While I have no doubt that there was some reporting bias, it's always easier to blame your parents than admit fault yourself. I've noticed that as a parent somehow along the way. It is, and you know, this whole concept of digital natives versus digital immigrants ourselves is a good one. Our kids have grown up with it, so they have formed a code of conduct, maybe with our help and the help of groups like NetSmart. But, you know, when my kids were born, I didn't own a cell phone. And when my kids first got cell phones, they weren't smartphones. And, you know, I didn't have a smartphone until, about 5 years ago, I think. So, yeah, we are new to it. And so for us, it's such a good point. And that I was going to ask you about just that, about also being parents that are digital immigrants. We don't know how to set up that code of conduct for our digital natives.
Yeah. Well, and again, that's why I recommend in the home. The opportune situation is when those two are working together. And I realize that's a tough thing. And throughout the history of teenagers and parents, that's been a tough thing. But I think the real solution there is to rely on that expertise and that experience. They know these apps. They've tried all the new apps. They know what works and what doesn't work. And if we turn to them and say, hey, what do you think is negatively impacting your digital life? And what's positively impacting it? Let's create a plan in our family that promotes the positive and we discourage the negative. And can you help me as a parent? Like, I'm not the best at this, you know? And one of the things that we, after having that conversation in our assemblies about texting and driving and parents, we send the students home. We say, go home and set up your Bluetooth connection in the car for your parents, or show them how to respond to a text or take a call via hands-free devices. Help them, because you guys are really good at technology. And that's just the beginning step of creating this conversation that we hope to do, so between the parents and their kids.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with Max Rogers from NetSmarts. That is spelled NetSmartz. And if you go to netsmarts.org, again, NetSmartz, there's a pretty good webpage there. And you have an issues page that's that you can click on and get all sorts of information. Children and as victims, identity theft, revealing too much, social media, cyberbullying, inappropriate content, cell phones, gaming, internet safety, email and chat rooms, file sharing, predators, and sexting. And I'm looking, I'm just going to click on one right now. We have, so I just went on predators. And let's see here. Your child should never meet face-to-face with anyone that they've met online without your permission and or attendance. Take an interest in your child's online activities and know with whom he or she is communicating. Is that a trust-type thing, or would you use a software application to understand the sites that your child visits?
You know, both is probably a good option, but the most important one, if you're going to pick one, is always trust and communication. If you're not having conversations about it, it's just not nearly as effective. One of our concepts that we teach in parents, in our parent courses, is mentoring over monitoring, which means always take the option to mentor over monitoring. You just can't do nearly as much, and you just can't monitor and filter and block everything. It's impossible. In fact, it's not super effective compared to preparing your child that they're ready to come to you when they see that strange or odd thing online, or someone says that odd comment that makes them feel uncomfortable, or shows them a picture that they didn't want to see. Their immediate reaction is, oh, I can go to mom and dad about this. I can talk to them. about this. We've talked about this before. I know I'm not going to get in trouble. And that's a big thing, by the way. We often ask students, why don't you go to your parents? And these are the younger students, usually middle school age, when something happens online that makes you uncomfortable. And the number one answer I get is, I'm afraid they're going to take away my device, or they're not going to let me play that game anymore, or they're going to get in trouble in some way. And that's because this conversation hasn't happened in that home yet, where mom and dad said, you know what, this is going to happen to you at some point. You are going to see something you don't want to see. It might be a pop-up. You might get an email. There are people on the internet who may say something that's going to make you uncomfortable. And when that happens, you're not going to get in trouble. It even happens to me as a parent. You can come and talk to me, and we can have a conversation about it.
So by having these conversations, you build trust that you're in this together. So one of the things you have here, for an example, is something called discussion starters. So I just went through a couple of tips. You know, you should never meet anyone face-to-face, you know, all that kind of stuff. But discussion starters that you can have with your children. What do you know about online predators? Have you met anyone online who asked you to meet face-to-face? What would you do if someone asked to meet you in person? So there's and there's a bunch more. So that's good as well. So each of these topics that I went through, you have tips and discussion starters for your children. So it's pretty good information.
Yeah, and we also recommend in the additional resources below, you can see videos, and you may watch those videos first beforehand as a parent, and then pick one that's appropriate for the age of the youth you want to talk to, or that you can show to all the youth in your home, regardless of age, that can start as a discussion starter too. The videos can be really impactful, especially for students that respond to media that way.
Again, the website is netsmarts.org. That's netsmarts.org. And Max, is this a national organization, and you're just Utah-based, is that right?
Correct. I'm glad you brought that up. Yeah, netsmarts.org is a national organization provided by the National Center for Missing and Exploited Kids. A lot of times people recognize those by the folks who used to put the pictures on the milk cartons for the missing kids, who are still tracking down missing kids. You see their photos as you check out at Walmart. The National Center, the NetSmarts program was started by the National Center and the Boys and Girls Clubs of America here in Utah. My staff are employees of the Boys and Girls Clubs of Utah, and we provide NetSmarts programming here in Utah along with our own programming to schools as we adjust it as necessary. We may add video clips here and there and cater exactly to our audience here in Utah and what students are responding to and that they're not. So that's what we're doing here in Utah. We're kind of providing NetSmarts among students here in Utah.
All right. You must have requests to come to schools all the time. I mean, are you just constantly driving around from school to school to school giving some of these trainings?
Yeah, I'm currently in southern Utah right now providing trainings in Washington County and St. George area. While I'm down here, I usually do two to three trainings at each school, and then I'll do two schools a day this whole week. And all my staff are doing the same thing in different areas throughout the state. And our goal is to eventually reach 100% of the state. As we get closer and closer to that figure, I don't know that it's possible with the six staff that we have, but we're getting as close as we can. Like I said, last year we trained to 70% of the schools in the state. We trained nearly, as far as individuals trained, we trained just over 400,000 youth last year.
Wow, that's impressive. Hey, I want to go back to something that you were talking about, you know, positive gaming, not killing zombies all the time. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned Minecraft, and I have only heard peripherally about Minecraft. I don't think my kids were ever into it. But you talk about how Minecraft can be, it's creative, it's strategic, it can be positive. And yet I know a couple kids, a couple relatives of mine whose heads are stuck in Minecraft like 24/7, and they've become very antisocial because of it. And so talk a little bit about, you know, if parents are wondering, what's appropriate? What is constructive and creative and positive, and when do you cross that line?
Yeah, even the best of things, if done too much, become an addiction. And that's one thing about digital media. It can be very addicting. This is, again, you got to come to that conversation in the home of setting boundaries as parents. But again, my recommendation on that is to do it with the kids' help. And part of that is maybe outlining, okay, you spend this much amount of time in school, you spend this much amount of time at home. How much should we allocate towards family time together that we should spend? Oh, that's an hour or two here. How much do you need for your homework? Oh, that's an hour, hour and a half here. And how much do you need for sleep? Oh, that's this many hours. And pretty soon we realized that maybe we were spending all of our free time playing Minecraft, and maybe that's a good way to approach it as far as starting and having that discussion. Plus, you're teaching your kids responsible behavior. It's going to help them throughout their careers and scheduling. I mean, it's just a great, meaningful conversation to have. Perhaps we should limit then your fun time on digital media to an hour each night, and then give you an hour to do your homework, and you can use the computer or iPad to do that. And, oh, wow, all of a sudden we're starting to get a plan here that we've created together, not just mom and dad enforcing and saying, even though Minecraft's so great, you can't play it for 5 hours every night.
When you're playing internet games with other kids, when kids are playing with other kids over the internet, does cyberbullying take place?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it does. And some games are worse than others. And when we ask students how many of them have, and like I was just at elementary school yesterday and I had students raise their hand, and usually about a third of the students raise their hand, even on elementary school level. This will be a grades 2 through 5. About a third of them will raise their hand and say that they've had people say rude or mean things to them while playing games online. And that's the majority of where bullying happens, especially for that age group. As students get a little bit older, they may get bullying on comments on their video on YouTube or comments on their social media. While some of these students, that age of students, are on social media, most of their online experience right now is usually through gaming, and a lot of the games they play now allow communication. So that age group is getting those negative comments here and there. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, it does. It does. And also under the National Center of Missing and Exploited Children, you mentioned that a child ID kit is important, and that in the event that a child is missing, and you say here one of the most important pieces of this kit is an up-to-date, good-quality photo. Is that something most people don't have?
I don't know. I would say I don't know that exact figure, but I would guess at least more than half of parents have a fairly up-to-date photo just by using their smartphone and regularly taking pictures of their kids. But that is a good reminder for parents to make sure they do have a new photo. I would say the toughest or the most likely group of parents who may not are those who haven't evolved into the technological world as deep. They don't have a new iPhone, or they may be lower income and they can't afford a camera phone yet where they aren't regularly taking pictures of their kids.
Right. You know, Max, we're going to let you go here in a moment, but I in scrolling through this website, it's just so fascinating, and especially those discussion starters to have with your child. And I'm looking at the page on cyberbullying, and no doubt, I mean, if we reveal too much about ourselves on social media, we leave ourselves more open to cyberbullying. But sometimes we cannot help being cyberbullied. And so some of the questions are, you know, how can you stop yourself from being cyberbullied? And I'm wondering, you know, I know that they're doing some work on resilience in the schools recently, and I'm wondering what you tell kids about, you know, being resilient and ignoring those cyberbullying messages. And of course, it's important to report them, but you know, we get little things all the time through social media that may not be complimentary.
Yeah, one of the concepts that we're teaching the kids right now. Grades 3 through 5, 3 through 6 is that, you know, you're of value and it's okay. There are people who are going to say negative things to you about yourself, and you have to know how to respond to that. One of the videos we use is by a son and his mother on YouTube, and it's linked on our Utah NetSmarts webpage, by the way, if parents want to use it to talk about bullying of this subject in their home. But the mom and his son teach the students 4 ways to deal with bullying, and one of them is kind of funny, and this is obviously the young man's solution. He says, "I love barbecue sauce, and just because I love barbecue sauce, that doesn't change the way I love barbecue sauce. If somebody says, 'Ew, barbecue sauce,' And then he turns it to us and he says, you're like barbecue sauce. You're awesome. You know you're awesome. And if someone tells you you're not, you can still remember and know that you're awesome and not let it bother you. And that's helping kids understand that it is going to happen. People are going to say rude and mean things to them, and they have to retain that self-worth still. And so that's one way to address it and remind students that they have that self-worth regardless of those negative comments. Because, you know, the majority of students are going to have negative comments directed at them via the internet throughout their life. So they have to become resilient to that.
Right. That's great. I'm awesome. I love barbecue sauce. it's good stuff. even for adults, right? It is.
Absolutely.
And your whole site is just so important for adults and children. And it's netsmarts.org. That's NetSmartz. And our guest is Max Rogers. And I'm just can't compliment you enough for the work that you're doing. And you're down in Washington County, St. George area today. When are you heading back up to Park City?
So I'm located in the Utah County area, and I'll be back there on Monday. And then we have multiple staff members. We have one specific staff member who's assigned the Park City area that provides all the trainings in the Park City Area School, which is not me, unfortunately, although I love Park City. His name is Cole.
All right. Well, that's good to know. Max Rogers, thank you so much for taking some time out of your busy day and talking to us on Cool Science Radio.
Absolutely. It was a lot of fun. So we'll stay in touch.
Okay.
Thanks again.
Sounds good. Thanks, Max. And it's Cool Science Radio. Stay with us. We'll be back in just a moment. We'll be speaking with the author of the book Hidden Figures, a New York Times number one right now on the nonfiction list, and also a new blockbuster movie, Kevin Costner movie. It was out as of January 6th, and it's a wonderful movie to head to during this long holiday weekend coming up. Stay with us. It's Cool Science Radio.
Spend the day and cover billions of years at the Natural History Museum of Utah. The museum offers innovative exhibits and hands-on experiences. Native voices explore the traditions of Utah's native peoples. The Great Salt Lake Gallery tells the story of the largest saltwater lake in the Western Hemisphere. The Past Worlds exhibit includes more than a dozen new species of dinosaurs discovered right here in Utah. Visit nhmu.utah.edu. The Natural History Museum of Utah is a nonprofit organization and a KPCW supporter.
This is Chris Robinson with Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties. KPCW is one of the many nonprofits our agents and companies support. They are the backbone of Summit and Wasatch counties in our incredible community. More info at bhhsutah.com.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peak, here with John Wells.
Yeah, and before the computer became an inanimate object, and before Mission Control landed in Houston, before Sputnik changed the course of history, and before the Supreme Court case, Brown versus the Topeka Board of Education, established that separate was in fact not equal, and even before the poetry of Martin Luther King Jr.'s I Have a Dream speech rang over the steps of the Lincoln Memorial, aeronautics, space research, and computer technology was dominating here in the United States, and several mathematicians were busy carving out a place for themselves in history. They were female mathematicians who were also black mathematicians who were also female. A movie called Hidden Figures, based on the book written by our next guest, Margot Lee Shetterly, tells the story of this group of bright and ambitious African American women who diligently prepared for a mathematical career. This book is number one on the New York Times bestseller list for nonfiction, and it's a top box office film in its first week on the big screen. We spoke with Margot Lee Shetterly in late September and thought you might want to hear that interview again just to spark your interest in this very important, up until now, untold story. Margot Lee Shetterly, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here this morning.
Yeah. Margot, I am a space freak. As a kid, I got popular science. I understood, read stories of all of the test pilots. I followed with extraordinary interest as a young kid, you know, the Mercury program, the Gemini program, the Apollo program. But this is a story, that I had never heard of before. And I had just never heard this. Why don't you take us through this a little bit?
Sure. Well, you know, as you mentioned, I grew up in Hampton, Virginia. My dad, he's now retired, spent his entire career there at NASA Langley in Hampton as a research scientist. So I knew of this story simply by virtue of growing up there, and the women that I write about are people who worked with my dad, or they were people in our community, you know, people you see at the grocery store. But, you know, it wasn't really until my husband, who's not from there, heard my dad talking about these women that, you know, and was like, well, I've never heard of this story. But, you know, I took a second look. And, you know, it really is a story that starts like so many things in our modern American society in World War II, which was a real transformative moment for women, for African Americans, for the labor market, for technology. And so the first five black computers, as they were called, a computer back then was a job title. It was usually a woman. The first five black computers took a seat in an office on the west side of the Langley Aeronautical Memorial Laboratory back in 1943 when America was in the full throes of World War II. They stayed on the job through the Cold War, and then some of them, particularly Katherine Johnson, who's a name many may have heard. She was awarded the Presidential Medal of Freedom last year, was very closely linked to the space program. She played a key role in calculating trajectories for some of the early Project Mercury orbits, and also worked on Project Apollo, getting Americans to the moon and bringing them back safely.
Yeah, and for folks that don't know this, we had computers during the Mercury program, but the computers did not have the applications, the algorithms, did not have everything that you needed to calculate these trajectories. The women that we're talking about were not double-checking computers. They were providing the trajectories and the analysis and all of the data that went into supporting these flights.
That is absolutely correct. They started out working on airplanes, you know, making airplanes fly faster, farther, safer. They ended up working on spacecraft, but in both instances, this was work that was done by hand. It was done with pencil and paper, with slide rules, with mechanical desktop calculators. And you know, then Project Mercury really was a moment in which the newfangled electronic computing machine started to take over for the computers who were living, breathing women. But up until that moment, you know, this was women's work. I mean, women not only undertook this work at NASA, at the Bureau of Standards, at the Army, where they worked on ballistics. And, you know, we're really, with the sort of distance of history, we're really seeing just how important that work is. There was another book called Rise of the Rocket Girls by an author named Natalia Holt, talking about the women who worked at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in California. And an upcoming book, another one coming out in December, by Dava Sobel, about the women working as computers at the Harvard Astronomical Laboratory. So these black women are part of a long and storied tradition of female computing and technology.
What a great story. You know, Margot, if you can take us back to 1943, and something that I started to think about was the access to a solid education for these African-American women, to even put them into the place that they were brilliant mathematicians. Did they have access?
They did. You know, these women were really the first generation of African-Americans who had that access, an expanding access to colleges. They all went to black colleges. They went places like Hampton Institute, which is now called Hampton University, West Virginia State in West Virginia, Howard University. You know, at that time, because black professors, no matter how brilliant, were not given access to teaching positions at places like Princeton or the University of Michigan, that talent was all concentrated in the black colleges. So these women, in many instances, were learning from people who were the first black PhDs in mathematics, for example, had very high expectations of them. And, you know, but the reality was of these black women and of all women, frankly, at that time, that if you were good at math and you studied math, gone to college, gotten a degree in math, the likelihood was that you were going to be a math teacher. And in fact, most of these women, prior to arriving at the Langley Laboratory, were teaching math at black schools throughout the South. So when the word got around about these jobs that had been recently open, only recently open in World War II, to African Americans by virtue of a pressure from a civil rights leader named A. Philip Randolph, this was a huge opening. These were the kind of jobs that changed your family's lives. You know, they were the kinds of jobs that had never been heard of in the black community. And these women were extremely excited to get a position as professional mathematician, really putting their skills to the fullest use.
Mm, it's such a great story. And, you know, I just re-watched The Imitation Game, taking place about the same time in England, Alan Turing and his team trying to crack the German enigma. And I guess it was a few years earlier, really. But what I noticed the second time around in viewing the movie was that all of these women who were taking, you know, who were listening, intercepting code, They were all women. And that was the thing that impressed me the second time I watched that I didn't see the first time around. Big role for women in this time.
A huge role for women during World War II. You know, we think of women as the Rosie the Riveters, you know, taking their places on the factory assembly lines and building the planes. Well, these ladies were there helping design the planes, helping, you know, work out the geometry of the wings, putting them in wind tunnels, making them more efficient. Highly technical, very important work that really did help tip the balance in World War II in the Allies' favor, and really turned America into an aeronautical superpower, which led into the Cold War and then to the space race. But without those women, I mean, just think how dependent we are today on our computers, how we rely on those calculations and how ubiquitous that is.
Right.
And that's the way those industries depended on their computers. It's just that those computers at that time were women.
And they had to negotiate racial boundaries on a daily basis. You tell a number of stories here, including Dorothy Vaughan sent Mary Jackson to the east side of Langley to do some work. And there was not a colored bathroom in the east side. They wouldn't let her use it. She had to walk all the way back to the west side. And the restaurants and the colored water fountains. I mean, these were, as I look at them, embarrassing and sad in the way that was set up. It was just a different time.
Absolutely. I mean, the unfortunate reality, you know, but this is history, so we have to look at it, you know, head on, was that these were the Jim Crow laws were the law of the state. This is Virginia in the 1940s. Segregation, both legal and, you know, social, very much a part of the way things were done. So, you know, and then enter this federal laboratory, you know, which has to both abide by the federal rules, which said, hey, we have fair employment, we're going to open these jobs to African-Americans. And yet they had these local rules that said, you know, there has to be segregation of the races in workrooms and bathrooms and all of that. So, you know, a woman like Mary Jackson, who ended up becoming the first African-American woman to be an engineer at NASA back in the 1950s, you know, coming with a very good education, an extremely good mind for math and engineering, supported by her bosses, and yet at the same time subject to eating in the colored cafeterias and going to the colored bathroom.
Yeah.
So, you know, for me, telling the story was a way to sort of capture so many of those, the top topics, you know, the most important, the defining moments in so many ways of the 20th century. And that really involved, you know, the transformation in the rights for African-Americans, for women, And, you know, also that Margo, of World War II and the space race plane. Yes.
I apologize. I'm going to have to interrupt you. We're unfortunately out of time, but we want to thank you, Margo Lee Shetterly, who has written Hidden Figures, fascinating book. And thank you so much for joining us this morning on Cool Science Radio.
Again, Margo Lee Shetterly. We spoke with her back in September about her book Hidden Figures, which, of course, is a new blockbuster movie. Not only is the book the number one on the nonfiction New York Times bestseller list, but it's one of the top movies. It was released just last week, and I haven't seen it yet, but I'm really looking forward to this weekend.
We should go see it together.
Let's do that, John.
You know, when you think about these four realities, which were really big, they were black, they were women, they were in the South, and they're living in the 60s.
Yeah.
And not only did they survive, but they did so much more than that. They went right to the top and not only played a role in the entire race in getting John Glenn to orbit the Earth, but eventually all the way up into landing people on the moon. And they just thrived, and they, in a very, very tough environment.
Such a great story. Well, I'm really glad that we had a chance to speak with Margo Lee Shetterly. It's Cool Science Radio. Stay with us. We'll be back to talk about a few cool things happening in science when we return.
Hi, this is Dr. Juliana Miller from Miller Orthodontics, a proud supporter of The Local View with Randy Barton. With a combined 45 years of orthodontic experience, my husband and I are now raising our family and working full-time in the Park City community. There are so many reasons to smile in Park City. More information at m2ortho.com.
And welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peak, here with John Wells. I want to thank both of our guests today, Max Rogers from NetSmarts. Again, what a great organization, creating digital citizenship, teaching kids and their parents and us as adults how to navigate through the digital world. So the website NetSmarts, NetSmartz.org, a fantastic resource. And Margo Lee Shetterly with Hidden Figures. A couple of cool science stories. Last week, or maybe it was the week before, I lose track, we spoke with Bill Andrews. He is the editor for Discover Magazine. We speak to him each year about the 100 top science stories of the year. And going over some of those stories last week, of course, we didn't have enough time to get into a lot of them that were very interesting. But one of those that caught my attention was a new way to heal traumatic brain injuries that surfaced in the news over 2016. And, you know, that's a big topic here in Park City with so many athletes and really concussion and traumatic brain injuries being quite pervasive and ubiquitous, and how to deal with them and how to bring us back so we're hopefully can heal from those injuries. So a short protein fragment, or a peptide, it's a new discovery, and that peptide is called CAQK, is being worked on to be able to attach this amino acid to some components of the meshwork surrounding brain cells. So basically what happens with traumatic brain injuries, you've got a primary injury, which has a lot to do with inflammation in the brain. That's what they go in and treat in a crisis moment, is that primary injury. But the secondary injuries have to do still with inflammation, but high levels of free radicals in the brain and your neurons just kind of freaking out and causing permanent damage. Well, invasive therapy, injecting medicine into the brain, is risky, and the way they've been injecting intravenously is not as effective. And so now they have used this CAQK peptide to also be inserted in intravenously, and they're seeing great improvements along with those secondary injuries during a traumatic brain injury. So really interesting. I thought that one, I forget which number of the 100 top stories of the year, but lots of promise there.
Yeah, and also they had a separate story about new ways of being able to understand and diagnose Alzheimer's earlier. And so it's, and I would mention that we've decided to bring Bill back next year, next week, and he's going to be with us. And we look forward to talking about some of those stories that we didn't get to. And then next year, January 1st, we'll have him on for the entire hour because he's so interesting. And Discover just does a great job with all of that.
That's right.
I'll also mention that Dahlia Kirschbaum is going to be with us next week. And this will be Dahlia's third time on the program. We first had her on in March of 2014, 4 days after the launch of that great satellite, the GPM, Global Precipitation Management Satellite, that is so sophisticated and provides 3D CAT scans of storms. So we had her on right when it launched, as they were starting to shake the thing down and do some testing. We had her after it had looked at a bunch of hurricanes and things. And now we're going to have her on again next week to get an update on GPM and some other things.
She's one of the greatest spokespeople for NASA. Just wonderful, wonderful spokesperson. Really interesting. Dahlia Kirschbaum. And so just a preview, I thought this was funny. One of the interviews that I was reading about what Bill Andrews is going to talk about next week, which has to do with an organ, 79th organ or not.
You would think that we'd know all the organs in the body.
That's right.
But this is an organ that's been around for a while, but they never really gave it a lot of credit. I hope it's not like Pluto, where they make it an organ, and then, you know, a year later they say, you're not an organ anymore.
I read that, and I had to laugh, because you're always lamenting how Pluto is no longer considered a planet.
I'm okay with it now.
It got demoted. Oh, you've gotten over it. You've healed.
Well, actually, I'm okay with it, because I looked into it a little bit more, and it really shouldn't be a planet, so that's cool.
Okay. And just like the mesentery shouldn't be an organ, or should it?
Well, they say it should be, but the fascinating question is, who is the arbiter of what's an organ and what's not an organ?
It seems to me that it would be, and I know nothing about this, but it's something that provides a function in your body, that's a mass of tissue performing a function. What do you think?
Yeah, that's good with me.
Okay, we'll go right to thank our underwriters, and we'll be back after this.
This is Angela from Peak Art and Frame, sponsors of Cool Science Radio on KPCW. Peak Art and Frame offers local photography and artwork, as well as digital printing, custom framework, and mirrors. Open Monday through Saturday and located in the Walmart Shopping Center, 649-0801 or peakartandframe.com.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided in part by AMA Waterways and Park City Air, Cruise, and Travel, 565-4730, parkcityaircruiseandtravel.com. Park City Bike Demos, Kearns Boulevard next to Adolph's, parkcitybikedemos.com. Long, Reimer, Weiniger, Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, lrw-law.com, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and listeners like you.
Thanks for tuning in to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peak, here with John Wells. Thanks to our underwriters, the Natural History Museum of Utah, San Francisco Design, Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties, Peak Art and Frame, Nexus IT, Park City Mountain, and Davidson Orthopedics. And
I don't know if we piqued everybody's interest on the 79th organ, but it is called mesentery, M-E-S-E-N-T-A-R-Y. And it is a broad fan-shaped fold that is connected to the upper and the lower intestine. And it sort of keeps things together.
I'm on the edge of my seat. That'll be next week, talking to Bill Andrews of Discover Magazine, a really great guy to talk to. We always enjoy having him on the show.
Yeah.
You're listening to KPCW Park City. It's time now for news.